This is Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper.
The way we treat addiction has changed over time, and the medical community is learning more about addiction in its efforts to find solutions to the current opioid epidemic.
To find out more about how addiction works, producer Mark Lavonier spoke with Dr. Richard Rawson, a research professor at the Vermont Center on Behavior and Health at the University of Vermont. Rawson has been working in addiction research and treatment development for decades.
Dr. Rawson, thanks for joining us on Take Care today.
Glad to be with you.
How has our collective understanding of addiction evolved over time?
Well, in the early 20th century, addiction was really viewed mainly as immoral, illegal behavior that should be treated by punishing it and by sanctioning people. And the criminal justice system was really how we initially addressed people with addiction. Over time, we came to see about the 1950s and 60s that this was something that could be addressed with treatment. But the treatment that developed was really kind of a counseling, spiritual, peer-based treatment that had very little evidence of effectiveness. In more recent years, we've used science to develop our treatments and to better understand the actual foundation of addiction.
When does addiction happen? How is it different for different people?
The common thing of addiction is they all involve brain changes. We now know that addiction is a brain disease. It's very much like disorders like schizophrenia and depression and other behavioral illnesses like that. Now, different people, because of their genetics, because of their early histories, have different vulnerabilities to addiction. Some people can get addicted very quickly. Others, it will take longer. But no matter who you are or what your genetics are, if you use drugs in a chronic enough way, you'll get addicted.
So that timeline really just depends on one's personal brain chemistry and what they might be susceptible to. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it has to do with, you know, the genetics of people's brain chemistry as well as early experience kinds of changes that affect how the brain is modified. So you can give the same amount of drugs to two different individuals, and based on their early history and their genetics, one person will become profoundly addicted and the other person won't develop addiction.
Is there such a thing as an addictive personality, or would it be better said if someone has an obsessive personality? Or does that have nothing to do with it because of the genetics and brain chemistry factors involved in addiction?
The whole concept of personality as a explanatory concept really has become far less useful now that we have much better markers of brain changes, genetic underpinnings, neurobiology, and all of those kinds of factors that give us much better predictive data. So the personality thing was a concept back in the 60s and 70s, but it really hasn't ever been very explanatory. So it's not really used much anymore.
Okay. Is there something about opioids in particular that seem to have made addiction to these substances so rampant?
Well, opioids are a special category insofar as they mimic brain chemistry that we have naturally. The body and brain have chemistry called endorphins, which are the body's own natural painkillers. And opioids are chemically very similar to those. When you take opioids over time, you change the brain's production of endorphin and you change the brain's own natural chemistry. And opioids produce a very profound addiction that really is different qualitatively than other addictions that we see. When someone's brain gets addicted to opioids, it really produces some changes that are going to really require long-term help in reversing that process, if it's reversible at all.
So can you talk to me about the relationship with opioids and pain management and healthcare, and maybe that slope that gets a little bit more slippery sooner rather than later?
One of the things, in the United States in the late 90s, we had a group of pain medicine doctors. The whole pain medicine field developed in the late 90s and early 2000s. At the time, there was a recognition that there were many people in the United States who were in pain as part of an illness or an injury, and they were receiving inadequate pain care. And they really existed, and there were people who were suffering unnecessarily. And so we started to see these movements to provide better attention to pain, because if you don't treat pain, effectively, it can exacerbate all kinds of other medical conditions. Patients in pain don't do very well. So there was development of new painkillers. There was this new belief that if you use pain medicines for the treatment of pain, for people who are actually in pain, that there's very little liability for addiction. And that was wrong. That was an inaccurate statement, but it very rapidly was used by pharma in particular to really promote this idea that we should be providing people with lots more pain medicine, and you really didn't need to worry that much about addiction. So what we saw is in the late 90s and early 2000s, driven by funding from pharma and by this new belief, you saw lots of symposia where the message was, give your patients plenty of pain medicine so that you're not under-treating pain. Pain became the fifth vital sign, so that doctors, when they assessed a patient for any kind of medical consideration, had to ask them to take their blood pressure, pulse, temperature, and measure their pain. And if their pain was above a certain level, they were responsible for treating it. And that's where we started to see bucket loads of drugs like Vicodin and OxyContin and others being pumped out into the communities with very little concern about addiction because of this belief that if somebody's in pain, they're not going to get addicted. That was a huge mistake, and that's been the genesis of the current opioid epidemic.
You're speaking to us today from a state that's been quite progressive when it comes to the opioid epidemic and treatment. So what are you doing there, or what's Vermont doing that's successful, and could these models be replicated elsewhere?
7 or 8 years ago, the director of public health in Vermont and the governor and the head of the Medicaid office all made a strategic decision to view opioid addiction as a public health problem and to take a public health approach. They looked at the research literature. They said that opioid addiction is a brain disease, and by far the literature on treatment suggests medication-assisted treatment, use of medicines like methadone and buprenorphine and naltrexone can be essential in helping people with this brain disease. And so they made a huge effort to expand access to medication-assisted treatment, and that's made all the difference in Vermont. We now have per capita by far the highest number of people in treatment in Vermont in the United States. There's no waiting list for people to get medication-assisted treatment. With Vermont's Medicaid expansion, there's very few uninsured people who cannot afford to get the medicine. And so we've seen Vermont be really the first state that's taken advantage of the tremendous benefits from medication-assisted treatment and have increased access to it greatly.
So with the statistics that have proven themselves maybe fly in the face of, well, you could be fighting fire with fire by putting medication to combat other medication?
Yeah, that's been one of the arguments, and that really is these medicines, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone, these are medicines that are provided to patients under controlled circumstances. They're monitored. They're far less abusable than the street drugs. And in the current environment, where the main street drug we're seeing is fentanyl, which is an extremely dangerous drug, the use of these other medicines to allow people to not be in withdrawal, to function effectively, and to have normal, productive lives makes that whole issue of giving people a drug to treat a drug irrelevant and completely unhelpful in addressing the epidemic.
One more thing I wanted to ask you. What are the first steps that an addicted person should take right after admitting that they have a problem?
If you're talking about opioids specifically, they should get in contact with a healthcare professional who can have them assessed and, in my opinion, get them under medication-assisted treatment as quickly as possible. Having a delay between the point where you realize you need to get treatment and getting into treatment is a period of time where we see a lot of people not make it. They overdose. So the first thing is to get into treatment. And probably the best place to do that, SAMHSA and the American Society of Addiction Medicine all have websites where you can have a list of buprenorphine providers so that you can find a doctor in your local area who prescribes these medicines and have an assessment with that physician. What I would not recommend is going to the website, putting in drug rehab, and seeing the incredible array of rehab programs that are not effective for treating opioid dependence, and in fact may be dangerous as a way of treating opioid dependence.
Dangerous how?
Well, if you go into a rehab, they withdraw you from opioids, give you some counseling sessions, and then discharge you onto the street, your tolerance for opioids dropped dramatically. If you now use the same dose of drugs, if you relapse, that first dose of drugs can be fatal because you're now at much higher risk to overdose because you've been withdrawn and your tolerance is dropped. So this model of putting somebody in a rehab, discharging them to the street, not on medicine, is an incredibly dangerous strategy, but it hasn't stopped the rehab industry from continuing to use this model and continuing to have many people overdose in the aftermath of their treatment.
That is very interesting and a bit frightening, too. Dr. Richard Rawson, thanks very much for being with us today on Take Care.
Okay, thank you.